BioCentury This Week is brought to you by Jato Capital, a global leading independent private equity fund dedicated to biopharma. Jato Capital has built a patient benefit-driven approach aimed at financing and accelerating the development of groundbreaking medical innovation. Jato's unique investment strategy combines significant capital and expert support to companies and their management teams, ranging from clinical development to market access for cutting-edge innovations with one main objective: go faster for the patient. Learn more at jato.life.
Welcome to BioCentury This Week, the podcast with BioCentury's editorial team. I'm Jeff Cranmer, executive editor of BioCentury, and joining me today are my colleagues
Simon Fishburne, editor-in-chief,
Steve Osden, Washington editor,
and Paul Bonanos, director of Biopharma Intelligence.
On today's podcast, Boundless bounds on to NASDAQ, Avalon BioVentures sweat equity model, the Supreme Court hears a case critical for FDA, and the first complete response letter for lack of confirmatory trial enrollment goes to Regeneron. But first, breaking news from the World Health Organization. Then Paul tells us about the new Precambrian gene editing startup, What Biotech, and Simone brings us the scoop on Pete Townsend taking the helm at How Biotech. They certainly give biotech companies peculiar names.
Hold on. You mean Pete Townsend of the Who is heading How? I thought Who was first. What about How and what's what?
Townsend's third. He's How. First is Who.
Wait, what? Who's first?
That's right.
But hold on. How can I go second with what if we don't know who's first?
Yes, who's on first? What is second?
So how did Pete Townsend get in here? I thought the Who disbanded years ago.
That's right. Now Townsend's How. He's perfect. It's a longevity play. He's third.
How's what? What's on second?
Exactly.
What?
Listen, let's start over. How's Townsend? He's third. What gene editing is second? But we lead with Who?
Hold on, I'm confused. For Pete's sake, who's running Who and when's what?
No, Townsend is running How. That's third. And what's second?
What's second?
Exactly.
So what's first?
No, I just said what's second. Who's first?
Really? Then who's first?
You got it. Who's first, what's second, and How's on third. All right, Abbott and Costello have left the podcast studio here at BioCentury, but before we return to our regular podcast, we'd be remiss if we didn't mention RA Capital's announcement this morning of a series of ETFs, including biotechs under constant crush of existential threat of payer out-of-pockets causing a slow launch, which they assure us is trading under the symbol RA Bucket of Poops. That's right, boys and girls. RA pooped on April Fool's Day.
I would just like to quote their lawyer, Sarah Reed, who said, "You Dixit dude, res ipsa loquitur and other Latin stuff." Apparently, she is the only attorney in the world to practice corporate law in plain English.
All right. Well, hats off to RA Capital for giving me one of the better press releases I ever woke up to here at BioCentury. But hey, let's turn to finance. We have Boundless pricing its IPO last week. And Paul, I'm curious, how'd they fare?
Sure. I'll tell you, everybody's been watching the IPO market for signs of recovery, really just for, you know, the past couple of years. We had a few IPOs early this year, mostly late January, early February. I think there were five. Things went a little cooler. We didn't see anything too substantial on NASDAQ for a few weeks. And Boundless is now the first one after this gap. And they got what they wanted. They priced right in the middle of the range that they had proposed, right according to the terms, didn't upsize. They got a $100 million raise. And in the aftermarket, not quite getting the love. They priced at $16, and on Monday afternoon, as we're recording, they're trading below $14.
So, Paul, do you think Boundless is going to be disappointed by that, or, you know, they raised the money? But what do you think?
I mean, it's not going gangbusters, and, you know, most people would want a great result, a great first day pop and aftermarket. But I guess it's worth noting that most of the companies that have performed really well in the aftermarket have had at least some clinical data out there. And Boundless is a little bit earlier. They're in the clinic with two programs, and they will get to turn a card over for the lead one this year. The other one has a readout coming in 2025. They do have upcoming catalysts that definitely could drive value. So maybe they're just a little on the early side with milestones coming up instead of waiting until they had a readout to go public. That's one way to think about it. I mean, this is a company also that had really all the pieces in place except having some clinical data when they did go public. They were, you know, we had a read on this for a while. They had a strong syndicate. Arch Venture Partners in particular is a large stakeholder during the private years. And then one big clue last summer was Jamie Rubin, the former analyst from Goldman Sachs and PJT, became its CFO. She's also at Arch. She had taken EQRX public a couple of years ago, and seeing her go to a private company with pieces in place, like being in the clinic, having crossovers, you would have to think that an IPO is a strong possibility. So they had a lot in place. They do have upcoming catalysts. I don't think this is by any means a particularly weak performance.
I think it's one other thing I want to say about this company, because it sort of sits at this interface where it is a really interesting platform company. They are working on extra chromosomal DNA, but at the end of the day, and I'm sure Jamie Rubin knows this, you got to have a program that is an asset that you will get valued on. So, you know, it will be interesting to see how platform companies and early stage ones start to fare in this market. Might be tougher for them to start with, but hopefully the market's going to be robust enough to support them.
Paul, who's coming up in the queue behind these guys?
There is one more. It's a company backed by Versant from the beginning called Continuum. At least I think that's how you pronounce that. It's not spelled conventionally. That's developing small molecules for MS and fibrosis. And they've just proposed terms for a listing that would bring in something in the $150 million range if they go kind of right up the middle. I have not seen them on the NASDAQ IPO calendar yet, but a lot of companies that do propose terms manage to get out just a few days later. So maybe even as early as late this week.
All righty. And Paul, before I let you wander off into the Florida heat in search of lunch, I know that you caught up with Jay Lichter of Avalon BioVentures recently. It's a firm you've been following closely for years now. What did you learn?
Yeah, so as you say, I've been following them for a decade or so. They've been around much longer than that, several decades. And they've kind of just taken a big step. This was a fun profile to write. You know, in 2022, they created a new life sciences pure play firm. It's now Avalon BioVentures. The old one, Avalon Ventures, had been a hybrid firm with tech on the other side. It's based in San Diego. And you mentioned the sweat equity model. Just to explain that, you know, this is a bit of a differentiator for them compared with some other firms that do company creation or get in later, but that have been raising larger and larger funds all along. The current fund is $135 million, very modest in size. They do not do nine-digit mega rounds at launch. They go for typically very focused projects, and Jay is often the CEO incubating the company in-house from the beginning, providing leadership during the earlier days, hopefully advancing with less dilution than you would see for a much larger play. And ideally, if everything works out the way it's supposed to, the idea here is that the company can create some value and then an exit with a return that will be much bigger than what a larger firm could have gotten. So like what Jay said to me was, if you raise $1 billion, how are you going to get a 3x return on your fund? But if you raise less than 200 million, one or two great exits can bring the whole thing back.
And Janux was a big recent success for them, right?
Yes. And there it's not an exit yet. I used the word exit during the call, and Jay immediately said it's not an exit at all yet. But that's a T-cell engager company with a platform that's meant to avoid some toxicity issues that have always been a problem in that area. And it went public, I think it's the middle of 2021. And a few weeks ago, they had some pretty early data readouts, phase one readouts in prostate cancer and in some other solid tumors that investors really applauded. It nearly tripled the company's value in a day. They're now sitting around $2 billion in valuation market cap. And Avalon is still a top three shareholder. They still play a leadership role. Jay is chairman, and some of the top execs are Avalon people as well. And given the current valuation of the company, the firm's stake in that, in Janux alone, is now bigger than an entire Avalon fund, right? So it can bring back the whole thing. As Jay said, just about all their funds have had a single exit that brought back as much as the whole fund or more. There were some others. Synthorex is one from a few years ago. That was a couple billion dollar sale, I think. And now Janux, we can't call it a return yet because they're still a major shareholder. They haven't kind of harvested all of their holdings. But yes, that will be one that brings back the whole fund. And it's a great thing to tell your LPs when you're raising the next fund.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. No doubt. All right, Paul. Well, I really enjoyed reading the profile. You can find it on biocentury.com or via the link in the show notes. Okay, last week, the Supreme Court heard the mifepristone case. Steve, you donned your tinfoil hat and robe to attend the meeting. What did you learn? What are the tea leaves showing us?
Well, first, I think maybe a reminder of what's at stake. What the case is about is there's a group of physicians, none of whom have ever treated a woman experience adverse effects from mifepristone. They brought a lawsuit against FDA asserting that the agency's decades-old approval of the abortion drug was illegal because they said the agency didn't properly consider its safety. They also said FDA's subsequent decisions to relax distribution requirements were flawed. An appeals court ruled that too much time had passed to challenge the original approval, but it upheld the arguments about the distribution requirements. In my story, I wrote that this really opened a Pandora's box, or could open a Pandora's box, because if this group of physicians has legal standing to file a lawsuit against an FDA regulatory decision, and if judges give themselves the power to second-guess FDA's scientific and medical decisions in this case, there's really no end to the mischief that could follow. That's the argument that the biopharma industry is making, FDA is making, and their supporters. Any physician, for example, who believes that FDA's approval of a vaccine or a psychiatric medicine or contraceptives or any other drug was flawed would be free to try to find a judge who agrees and overturn or change a regulatory decision. So, the majority of the Supreme Court justices seem ready to find a way to tighten the lid on Pandora's box. The liberal judges were skeptical both of the notion that these physicians have standing to sue in the first place and of the idea that judges are qualified to rule on the merits of FDA's decisions. Some of the conservative judges, notably Gorsuch and Barrett, said laws allowing physicians to avoid actions they oppose for moral or religious reasons are sufficient, and that it would be an overreach to ban mifepristone for all women everywhere in the country all the time to protect these physicians from having to undertake actions that violate their conscience. Of course, there were a couple of justices who were totally on board with second-guessing FDA and with granting standing to physicians who had even the most tenuous connection to the agency's regulatory decisions. Alito, he was ready to rewrite the REMS for mifepristone right there during the oral argument. He said, well, what about this and what about that? And he and Thomas both also expressed enthusiasm for applying the Comstock Act, a law that hasn't been enforced for almost 100 years, to prevent distribution of mifepristone through the mails. So I think my guess, you said reading the tea leaves, my guess is they're going to find a majority of five judges who are going to say that there wasn't standing, or even if there was standing, that the conscience clauses and regulations and law are sufficient to protect these physicians, and they'll find some way to dispose of the case that way.
Steve, just a quick question then. Okay, personally, I think it's a shame it's not going to be 9-0 by the way you are talking about this. And obviously, it's been broadly covered in the media. What I want to ask you whether this really just is going to shut it down altogether. We've seen in various cases, people come back and try doing something in various different ways. Obviously, I think most of us can recognize that the impetus behind this is really an anti-abortion movement rather than specifically one related to the FDA. But what are your thoughts in terms of FDA being out of the woods if this goes the way that you predict?
Well, I'm not sure that I actually predicted what's going to happen. I think that there's a majority on the court to do something. The question is whether what they do is really, as you said, shuts it down. So the best outcome for biopharma companies and for FDA would be, you know, if the Supreme Court threw the case out on the standing issue and said, that's it. There's another possibility, though. Eva Temkin, who wrote the amicus brief for bio and for a number of biopharma companies and biopharma executives, I think more than 350 signed on to it. She told me that one of the worst outcomes would be if the court makes a kind of muddled decision that sends the case back to the district court, which would then send it to the appeals court, which would then send it back to the district court potentially, and what she called a Ferris wheel of litigation and uncertainty around the whole thing. That's a distinct possibility. You really can't predict what's going to happen. Another thing that I would predict will happen, it seems from their comments during the oral arguments that Justices Thomas and Alito are likely to write a minority opinion that mentions the Comstock Act, and that might provide an avenue for future litigation. You can bet that the interest groups that oppose abortion in the United States aren't going to give up if they don't win this case, and they're going to be filing litigation trying to prevent access to mifepristone on one ground or another. The real question, I think, is whether it will have this larger potential for larger disruption of FDA's regulatory authority and of really creating chaos for drug developers and for patients.
Steve, another story you were on last week involves accelerated approval. A year and a half ago, Congress gave FDA the power to refuse to approve an application for accelerated approval if a trial to confirm clinical benefit was not underway. The agency has now used that power for the first time, rebuffing an application for a Regeneron bispecific for a form of B-cell lymphoma. Steve, should we expect to start seeing FDA do this more often?
Well, it depends on whether sponsors continue to file applications for accelerated approval, having failed to start or have well underway their confirmatory trials. The circumstances in this case, I think, made it easier for FDA to set a precedent and show that it's serious about wanting confirmatory trials to be well underway when companies apply for accelerated approval. I think FDA officials looked at the Regeneron application and basically thought, look, if we aren't going to reject this one and require the confirmatory trials be well underway for this application before they seek accelerated approval, we'll never do it. The circumstances in this case include the availability of two other drugs in the same class that have received accelerated approval for the same indications or similar indications, and the fact that confirmatory trials were fully enrolled and have been going on for some time when those two drugs received accelerated approvals. I think in addition to making a point in this case, FDA could be concerned that Regeneron will find it difficult to complete its confirmatory trials because the readouts on the confirmatory trials for the other two drugs are going to be coming out soon. And that might affect the enthusiasm for patients and physicians to participate in Regeneron's trial.
Steve, in some ways, it was actually only a matter of time before somebody got this kind of CRL. You could argue the language of well underway wasn't terribly specific. And so, you know, in that light, do you think it is only a matter of time before somebody else gets caught in this? Or do you think people will get their fingers burned? Do you think FDA is sending a message with this to say we're serious?
Well, they're certainly sending a message to say that they're serious. Whether other companies will try to push the boundaries, look, somebody's going to try to do it. It seems likely to me. And there may be circumstances where FDA is going to be more reluctant to do it than here. The consequences of doing this are that it delays accelerated approval of the drug. That's assuming that FDA would have given it. It delays it. And as I said, in this case, FDA can make the argument that delaying accelerated approval isn't going to hurt patients. And by the way, Regeneron's also making their drug available under expanded access or compassionate use. So you could make the argument in this case that really it's not going to hurt patients. That might not always be the case. There may be cases when companies haven't got their confirmatory trials well underway, and FDA would be very reluctant, properly so, to hold them up because it's a drug that patients really need and they don't have alternatives.
All right. Well, thanks for that, Steve, Paul, Steve, Simone. Thanks for joining today. All of the stories we talked about, you can find up on biocentury.com or in the show notes. And coming soon on biocentury.com, Stephen Hansen with the second quarter public markets preview. Steve Usden speaks to the new head of the EveryLife Foundation. And you'll also find our weekly deals, venture, and public equity reports. And you can catch the latest episode of the BioCentury show featuring Simone in conversation with Atlas Ventures' Bruce Booth on our YouTube channel. Thanks for tuning in. We will catch you next week. Kendall Square Orchestra provides the music for BioCentury this week. The group connects science and technology professionals and other members of the greater Boston community to collaborate, innovate, and inspire through music while supporting causes related to healthcare and education.
BioCentury would like to thank Jato Capital for its continued support of our BioCentury This Week podcast and our 24th annual BioEquity Europe Conference this May in San Sebastian.